What's up, guys? Welcome to Birdwatch, New Orleans Pelicans podcast powered by NOLA.com. I am Christian Clark, the Pelicans beat writer for NOLA.com, here today with special guest Mark Kriegel. He writes about boxing for ESPN.com. He is an analyst on NFL AM on the NFL Network. He was a columnist for the New York Post and the New York Daily News. He's also the author of biographies about Joe Namath and Pete Maravich. Mark, did I leave anything out?
I'm no longer working that early shift for the NFL. I do occasional essay pieces, but yes, you're correct. Mostly a boxing guy right now for ESPN.
Okay. So there's almost nothing to talk about right now about the NBA. We're at a standstill. We're going to be there for a while.
I see my guy Woj. He's on all the time. Without Woj, like, going to break.
Yeah. I mean, players aren't even allowed to practice at the practice facilities right now. I mean, a lot of these guys aren't even getting up shots or anything. So I figured this would be a good time to talk to you about one of the books you wrote. I read Pistol. It's the biography about Pete Maravich and his life for the first time when I was in high school. It came out in 2007. I just reread it while we're on this break, I guess. You know, Pete Maravich is relevant to a lot of people here in Louisiana, obviously, NCAA all-time leading scorer. And I just think he's a very fascinating guy. And I'm not sure how much of the nitty-gritty about his life that people know about.
If you're as old as me, you know. But I was an old fart before you read it the first time.
Well, I should probably rephrase. I don't know how many people my age know like the nitty gritty of his life. I feel like, you know, people my age know that he was this incredible showman, you know, one of the more skilled offensive players ever. But during his life, he dealt with this undercurrent of sadness. He was pushed very hard by his father, Press, and I think they had, you know, the most interesting part of the book is their relationship, I would say.
Yes, I specialize in non-functional or dysfunctional father-son relationships. Yeah. It's my area of literary expertise, my subspecialty.
So that's what made you get interested in writing this book.
I write a lot about fathers and sons.
Yeah. Did your dad ever drive you in the car, open one of the doors and make you dribble a basketball while he was at drive?
No. We lived in New York City, so that would have presented its own perils. But he did not.
So
he did criticize my grammar.
For those of you who don't know, that's actually one of the things that Press Maravich, you know, made his son do. He would have him sit down, lay down in the backseat, dribble the basketball outside the car, and drive the car around. Is one of the many weird ways that he had Pete work in his game. And I guess like one of my first questions
today would have been collared for child.
Yeah, I mean that's what I was going to ask you. Is like was Press Maravich the first like crazy sports parent?
The first. I'm sure he wasn't the first, but I think that he defines the archetype. You know, you've gone on to generations of little league dads. I'm sure there were crazy sports parents before, but people of that generation didn't have time to devote themselves to their child's athletic needs or, you know, specialize in any sport. Press, Pete's father, came from a peculiar set of circumstances that drove him. So he really was, I would accept that he was, whether he was the first or not, I don't know, but he constructs an archetype. He's certainly the all-time sports dad, let me put it that way. In terms of driving his son for his own ego, but I think it was more than that. It was what he saw in his son was a way to justify his entire life. And I see that all the time in boxing, which is in some respects an easier sport to write about. But I see fathers put their sons in the ring all the time to justify their own lives. It's a very peculiar and intense form of male vanity. I don't know if I've ever seen it in that kind of force as with Pete and Press.
One of the questions that I've had after reading this book is, you know, Pete arguably was the greatest ball handler of all time.
All of which was constructed, all those drills and stuff you see guys do today, all constructed by Press. But
yeah, I mean, Pete was you know, in the gym 6, 8, 10 hours a day as a kid, you know, almost every day working on his game, doing these drills that Press came up with to improve his ball handling, his passing, his shooting. How much of Pete being in the gym all the time and working on his game as a young kid was his love of the game versus just that was the expectation of, like, Press just saying, hey, this is just kind of the way it is?
I'm not sure that Pete ever really untangled all of that. He wanted to please his father. He loved his father very much. And they shared this mutual love. But at some point, and it's not until later in his life, and it was a short life, does Pete start to untangle the strands of this and come to terms with himself and ask, wait, who am I doing this for, me or my old man? But until then, you know, where his motivation came from, is this what I'm doing for myself or what I'm doing for my dad? I don't think he separated the two. This is what he A, loved, and B, did, and C, was encouraged to do with real desperate urgency from his earliest memory. He was the modern prototype ball player before there was one. A 6'6 guard, when they really didn't have 6'6 guards. And he wasn't, you know, he didn't play to two. He needed to have the ball in his hands. And all of the stuff, all of the drills, some of the crazy drills, first of all, they're not that crazy because they're still practiced today by successive generations of not just good players, but great players. But there's an intensity that he practiced with. Now, whether that comes internally from himself or from his dad, the truth is it comes from both. And Pete was a genius. And one of the characteristics of genius is the ability to practice and to repeat without pause, to practice harder. You saw this with Jordan, to practice harder than your competition. That's what Pete had, ability to not just do Press's drills, but to do them again and again and again as if they were saving the family, which is what the construct that Press created.
Yeah, I think the point you brought up about, like, you know, these drills, they're still, you know, widely practiced today. I remember in high school, we would do like the same drills you see in like the homework basketball series. Like, I think Press Maravich is responsible for a lot of the skill and how players work on their individual skills, even in today's game.
Great ball handlers. Jason Williams told me how much those videos meant. I'm dating myself now, but Rafer Alston, a New York City playground legend, but guys who were world-renowned ball players of successive generations, guys who came 20, 30 years after Pete, still acknowledge their debt to him and the homework basketball type.
Yeah, Rafer Alston crossed over too.
Right, but what's really an anomaly about Pete, if you look at old films from the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, the first thing you say is, like, look at those skinny guys. Like, there's no way they could get a game today. It would be silly. And one of the few guys you could see playing in today's game is Maravich. The other guy, I mean, I don't know who you can say this about, not even Jordan. His game would work better today than it did then. It's almost like he had no one to play with then. But if you dropped him in today's game, the fluency with which he played, the things that he could do, the range he had, remember he played before the three-point line, all of that stuff would have made him better, and certainly better in a team context today than he was then, which is another way of saying what Press originally argued, look how far ahead of the game my son is. It was a virtuoso talent back then, and I think he would have been able to fit in better with the other guys today. The only other guy you could really see playing today, I mean, Chamberlain, but Pete would have been better today than he was then because people would have known,
there wasn't even a three-point line until the last two seasons of his pro career, right? When, you know, he really wasn't even himself.
Yeah, but no one really used it. No one knew what the hell it was. And if you look, a guy averages, I forget what the number is now because I'm so old and my memory is challenged, but he averages 44 points a game in college. And if there had been a three-point line, and think about the college three-point line, he would have averaged, if someone did the numbers, like about 52. Some of the shots he took really weren't threes. They should have been like fours.
I mean, you know, if Pete Maravich played today, he would be one of those guys who's taking 8, 9, 10 threes a game. I mean, he just would, I think.
Right. And also you see he had the same type of control of the ball that you see in Steph Curry. Steph Curry is not a tortured soul. That's why his game is fully functional. Pete was. It's why it's more dramatic. But I see elements of his game also in old Manu Ginobili. Again, a fully functional player, not conflicted like Pete, but the same type of control of the ball.
Interesting. So I want to talk about just his LSU days briefly. Pete, originally, when he was nearing the end of high school, he didn't want to go to LSU. He wanted to go to West Virginia. And it was really kind of this package deal where LSU said, hey, Press, come coach our team, bring our son with you. And one of the ways that the Press kind of sealed the deal, Pete made him agree, like, oh, you got to get me a new sweet car or whatever. So Press gets him the car, brings him to LSU. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things is Press Maravich, yes, he was this crazy sports parent, but he was a brilliant basketball mind in his own right. Like John, you have in the book, John Wooden saying, you know, he's one of the greatest offensive minds of our generation, whatever. And he'd been a successful college coach, but he'd been a successful college coach by promoting team basketball and making, I guess, coalescing his team into something great. And when he got to LSU, he just started going about things in a much different way, right?
It was driven by ego. Let me take a step back, if I could, and try to understand Press. Because with Pete, Press broke every single damn rule that made him not a good coach, but a great, if unheralded, one. Everything that made him good, he broke in the case of his own son. And he knew better, but he couldn't help himself because he figured my legacy, how people judge me, my salvation is going to be my kid, is going to be Pete. So he put all of that on Pete, which is one of the reasons why Pete cracks. But going back, Press Maravich grew up in this small industrial steel town of Aliquippa under the light of a steel mill, a furnace. You know, the sky is orange. And he gets warehoused in basically what we would call today like the special ed class. And this is the 20s. So he's basically kind of an orphan. He doesn't fit in. They think he might have some, you know, mental retardation, or he's slow or withdrawn or whatever it is. And then of all things, a missionary, because the roots of the sport are in like Christian missionaries, gives him a basketball. And the kid's life, he's in grade school, changes, completely changes. He finds something he's not good at, he's great at. So he becomes an obsessive, compulsive, brilliant basketball guy in a time before basketball really was, certainly was America's sport. So Press associates everything that's good in his life with the game. And when he has a kid who turns out to be 6'6" and incredibly dexterous with his hands, he decides, I'm going to make this kid the greatest basketball player in the world. He does. Certainly the most skilled, but he drives everyone around him crazy in the process. He had been a great coach. He roomed with John Wooden during these summer camps. Wooden told me before he passed, remember, he was known as a defensive coach, Press. Wooden told me, forget that, he was the greatest offensive mind I've ever worked with. They were complete opposites. So Press would curse. He was loud. He would smoke. And Wooden was measured and modest and certainly didn't curse. But Wooden had so much respect for Press that when he signed Kareem, then Lew Alcindor, he went to Press and asked, can you help me to design an offense around this guy, which became the high low, which is, you know, coaches, they don't like to give credit like that. And here's Wooden, maybe the greatest coach of all time, telling me there was no one smarter or better than Press. The other thing about Press is that he was great. Like, let's say he got me and you and a few more guys from the Y. He could turn a crew of like nobodies into a contender in the ACC. He'd always coached at football schools in the deep South, Clemson, eventually LSU, but he gets a shot at NC State and they win a title. They beat a greatly talented Duke team with basically like, five guys named Joe. And it's because of Press, because he taught them defense, because he taught them unselfish, ensemble basketball. And then he goes to LSU. He finally gets an offer, and he violates every damn rule that made him that great, unselfish, good basketball coach, which is everything goes through my kid. He's going to shoot every single time because Press thought, I want to change the game. I want this to be my legacy. I'm never going to get the credit having taken all those losses at Clemson or during his time at NC State. My legacy is going to be my son. I'm going to change the game through my son. So Pete wanted to go to West Virginia and be the next Jerry West. Press says, no way, I'll get you a car. I mean, today it would be a father-son recruiting violation. Back then it was just, no, you're coming with me. And Pete shook his dad down for a sports car. But LSU was like, the gym was like a, it was for rodeos and cow shows or horse shows. I don't know, whatever. Livestock shows. It smelled like a barn. It wasn't like LSU, like you think of today, like Shaq, They had to basically sell basketball in the deep South. First, South Carolina, where it didn't work. And then LSU, where it sort of did, but it had its own challenges. It's not a place that, really had embraced basketball before. So the whole emphasis was, look at my kid. Look what he's going to do. Watch him go. You'll never see anything like this. And Wooden had cautioned Press one night. Press brings Pete back to perform for all the other coaches. And he's a little kid and he does all the tricks. And Wooden says, wow, I've never seen anything like that. He goes, but Press, you'll never win a championship with him playing like that. And he goes, yeah, but he's going to be the first $1 million player. And they were both right.
One of the things that I couldn't help but wonder, what would Pete's pro career would have looked like if he'd just gone to West Virginia or just, I guess, gotten away from his dad a little bit, because, he had a lot of individual success as a pro after a first tough couple of seasons, but he wasn't on winning teams. He wasn't on teams that really ever made deep playoff runs. I mean, I guess it's kind of unknowable, but I just wonder what things would have looked like if he just had those couple of years to get away from his dad and learn from somebody new and had to play within a team system.
I think that he would have eventually come back to his dad because the bond was that strong, but he would have been a lot happier and healthier. It would have removed him, if only temporarily, from that matrix with his dad that, he needed that. He knew he needed that, and his dad couldn't let him go. But, the dad was depending on his son to essentially save him and create his legacy, which is, an unfair burden for any son. One of the things that surprised me in the reporting of the book, I went into it thinking Press would be one way, the complete overbearing SOB as a dad, like a great Santini figure. And he was not. There was a lot that was immensely compassionate, caring, and virtuous about Press. But when it came to his own son, he was blind. Again, like, just shoot the ball. Now, they didn't have anyone else to shoot and anyone else who could really, really play. The recruiting base then for LSU especially since they were only recruiting white players, was not particularly deep. And that's something else that plays into the story, the resentment and the adoration directed at Pete because he was playing a style associated with a black city game in a segregated white area. It's a difficult thing.
Yeah, I think the role of race is so interesting in Pete's career because, you know, as you just alluded to, there's, you know, this part in the book, and I think it comes from a Sports Illustrated profile, Pete, where this coach of an all-black high school in Baton Rouge says to the writer of that story, he's one of us. Like, a lot of people considered Pete to play the way, frankly, just a black person might play basketball back then, that it wasn't really, you know, white people didn't play like he did. But on the other hand, I mean, Pete goes to the Atlanta Hawks, and, you know, the Atlanta Hawks had had success before they got here. They won 48 games. They were a mostly black team. They won. But he gets there, and he's held up as, like, you know, the great white hope, basically. And they're worse than they were the year before, and there's resentment there. I guess I would say, you know, basketball in the Deep South, it was just hard for them to sell, you know, all black teams at that time. Is that fair to say?
No, they couldn't sell all black teams. In the pros, the colleges were still segregated. The style, I think, was associated with, it's not just a black style, but an urban style. The Globetrotters had a lot to do with it. I think if you ask Pete or press, they would tell you it's our style. But it certainly had its antecedents were the Globetrotters, all the stuff that's in press's head. But Pete becomes the great white hope pretty early in college. So what he's entrusted with is we have a segregated program. We need you to sell it. So how do you sell it? We got like the super white boy. And then the NBA picks up on it. They have a predominantly black team in the Atlanta Hawks and a really good team. Experienced pros. They knew how to play the game. The only thing wrong with the Atlanta Hawks circa 1969 was that they couldn't get by the Lakers, which was a pretty formidable outfit. So you had really experienced, respected old pros. And now you bring in the great white hope, a rookie who's making more money than all of us. Are you kidding me? It's a recipe for absolute disaster. It's impossible not to have resentment. And Pete didn't know how to play when he wasn't the center of everything. If he had gone, say, to West Virginia, he would have had a better shot. But he was coming from a place where it's me, 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 me. And now he's got to share. And he didn't know how to do it. He didn't know how to play ensemble basketball. The stuff that his dad had taught everyone else, he didn't know about. And so it was, of course, ripe for great and justifiable resentment. I mean, imagine how you would feel if you were on the Hawks and like, hey, we're the championship.
Yeah, I mean, they were literally a contender. And then they bring Pete Maravich in. And then they have this marketing campaign where they call themselves the new Hawks. Yeah.
Right. Like the old sucked. In fact, the new Hawks sucked a lot worse than the old Hawks. And he got saddled with that. But the other thing is, once again, you're trying to sell basketball in a football market. It happened first at LSU, then it happened in Atlanta, and eventually it happened in New Orleans. And the dynamic was the same in each of those towns. It's like, Pete, we want you to be the great white hope, super white boy. And eventually it came close to crushing him. That's a unforgiving burden, especially for a young guy.
You know, I would say most of his pro career, it just seemed like, you know, he was just an unhappy guy. I mean, there's this great anecdote in the book about, I mean, this was widely known at the time. He did this interview with, I believe, the Hawks play-by-play guy at halftime, and it came to light that you know, Pete believed in extraterrestrial life. That's all well and good. But he actually painted the words "take me" on top of his home.
But I think that that has to do with almost his suicidal feelings, which were evident back then. He wanted to be great. He didn't ask to be a great white hope. He got paid a lot of money, but he didn't ask to be like killed for it. What was he supposed to do? Turn down the money? So he was in this absolutely thankless position. And again, he had been trained as a virtuoso, not part of an ensemble. Today, it would have worked better. But so he paints this "take me" on the roof of his house. I just think for a long time, he wanted out. He wanted to be liberated from this entire construct. Like, get me out of this crazy world. I don't want to be the great white hope. I don't want agita from both sides. Please remove me from me from this.
So I was, you know, thinking about just who could you compare Pete Maravich to? And you hit on a couple of them earlier. And tell me if you think this is crazy or not. This does not have similar elements of race, but as far as, you know, incredible showmen, great ball handlers, ability to make tough shots, but they didn't always play winning basketball. I kept coming back to Kyrie Irving.
Well, I understand what you're saying. They're both shoot first guys, and they're both, I think, you know, me guys. I'm wary of the comparison. To me, Kyrie Irving is an incredibly skilled player with a great handle. And if you take away the one shot in the finals, I think he has an underachieving career. Teammates don't seem to respond to him. I'm not there, but certainly seems that way to me. He's like, to me, like the kind of guy who scores like 70 in a summer league game, and he wants like the NBA to be like that. Like,
but how is Pete different?
Just give me the ball and let me take care of this. And well, first of all, for Kyrie coming out of Duke, when he came out of Duke, he should know better. He should have a more adapted skill set. He should know how to play better with others. Pete was trained to be the show, the only show. And then, there are elements of the comparison I think are right on, but I don't think that you can remove race from this. The challenges, the burden that Pete had coming into this equation as the white guy on a black team in a game that was changing, carrying the mantle of what was still a segregated South into a desegregated league. That's nothing at all like the burden that Kyrie faced. Kyrie was about, I want to be the man. I want to get paid. You know, at one point it's okay to be second fiddle to LeBron. And then, no, I want my own squad. That's a different set of parameters than those that face marriage. I mean, look, I accept the elements of your comparison. Physically, a guy who always needs the ball, who didn't want to change. But I don't think you can factor race.
I think that makes sense. So in 1974, Pete is traded to the New Orleans Jazz, an expansion team. They're playing in the Superdome. They're attracting huge crowds. That's crazy to me to think about a basketball team playing there. And it seemed like it was a little better of a situation for him because there wasn't as much expectation. I mean, it was an expansion team, right? It's just like, you know, if you just put on a good show, that's good enough for us.
Right. It was an expansion team, so expectations were less. He was comfortable in Louisiana. I think that he had done a little bit of growing up. And his game had evolved as well. He's getting stronger. He understands stuff. And there's a stretch. He has this great 60-something point game against the Knicks. There's a stretch there. He's the best player in the game. Like, he's a bad man. It's like he finally, if briefly, figured this thing out. And then he hurts his knee. And he doesn't really come back from that. I think that Pete was one of these guys that, I can't do it unless it's perfect. He was an artist, and that hurt him. today, I don't think it would have been as devastating a knee injury, but had a horrible effect on him. Then he just never came back from it. But there's that brief window where he is the best, and you can't stop him.
That seems like, you know, just about the saddest part of his pro career to me is that it seemed like he had achieved some balance between, you know, I'm the show, but also, you know, I know that as the best player in the team, the highest paid player, it's my responsibility to set these guys up and make these guys better. It seemed like just as he was realizing how to do that, that he has like this devastating knee injury. I mean, I think they'd won 8 games in a row or something like that. This was mid-December when it occurred. It seemed like he might have been turning a corner, and then he has this knee injury.
you might still be having basketball in the Superdome. Zion could be in the Superdome. Well, not now, but you know. But there's this question. Eventually, all the hoopla that attended his Jazz career, the beginning of his Jazz career, it dies down, and you are left with this question that you know better than I has been posed over the years. Is New Orleans an NBA city? Or certainly in today's NBA, one of the interesting things about this story is that Pete really does point the way to the contemporary NBA where players are looked on as brands. I mean, today he'd have a sneaker deal before he got out of junior high school. But there is this question that lingers, is this a basketball market or is it an NBA market? I guess, you know, LSU is certainly a basketball team now. You look back on this thing and it seems sort of absurd, but you do have this question, can New Orleans sustain an NBA franchise over time? And I guess, you know, the same questions be asked of Zion once we get back, I hope, will continue to be asked of him that they were asked of Pete.
Well, I'm a relative newcomer in New Orleans. This is my first season covering the team full time. I mean, I just, you know, remember watching games when Anthony Davis was here, and it's like, man, Smoothie King Center looks empty. What I will say is that I don't think I have an answer one way or the other. All I'll say is that if there's one guy who can make professional basketball a huge deal in New Orleans, it's Zion Williamson. I mean, he is the perfect star for this city. I mean, look, he's only 19 years old, like guys change, but he is the perfect star for this city at this time.
The kind of athlete that can sell a game where it's never really been sold before, they share one characteristic. And this, obviously, Pete's game and Zion's are completely different, but neither of them look like anyone who ever came before. They're their own thing. They're the first of a kind. You know, there are players who are imitations, even improvements of previous versions. But Pete was really his own thing at that height, with that kind of handle. He was so funky at that size. Zion, I don't know. I guess you'd say Barkley, but still, that doesn't quite do him justice. But these kind of savior players have to be their own. They're their own thing. What hurt Pete is being depressive, and it doesn't sound like Zion is at all. That he has something good and healthy to sustain him. Pete had all the pressure in the world bearing down on him at all times, and you knew it. He gave you that sense. It came off him. It doesn't sound like Zion has any of that. Zion has a sense of joy. That stands him in great stead.
Yeah. You know, just depression was something that Pete dealt with until really the end of his life. And I think it's probably the greatest tragedy that it seemed like he found true happiness. You know, becoming a Christian for him was part of something that helped him do that. But, you know, he really did seem to find inner peace. And then, you know, just a couple of years later, he deals with this tragedy and it's all over just as he's discovered that piece that took forever to find.
You know, whether he says he's saved by Jesus Christ, and however you want to parse it, theologically, religiously, psychologically, I have no doubt that that's true. It's one of the interesting things about the story is that it cuts across so many lines that usually divide us. He continues to, here's a guy from born in industrial Pennsylvania, moved to the deep segregated South, but he continues to resonate in red states, in blue states, with religious people, with secular people, black people, white people. You know, it remains sort of iconic in the hip hop or post hip hop generation, wherever we are now, like with old white guys like me and before me. There's something about the idea of Pete Maravich that continues to be compelling for all sorts of people who are usually divided.
And one of the lessons I got, you know, Press and Pete, they had this idea of what basketball would look like. And part of it was that it would be exciting and up and down. There's an element of showmanship, but they wanted basketball players to be skilled. And I just wonder, what would Press Maravich just think of the game today when, you know, Zion Williamson, yeah, he can dunk on anybody, but like that guy could put it on the floor. You know, he can pass the ball. Even the big guys are skilled today.
This is what I'm talking about with Pete being the only guy I can think of who would be better today than he was then. And I think that I have a pretty clear idea. Press would come back, look at the game, and he would say, see, I told you so. This is where we were headed. And that is his true brilliance. He was able to design a player not for the game then, but for the game that would become. And that is the legacy of both the father and the son.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they would love the place that where the game is at now. It'd be exciting for them. How much basketball are you watching these days? I mean, not in this moment, but how much were you before the season paused?
For me, it's like all boxing all the time at this point. I watch the playoffs, watch the finals. When I was hired, it was to do some NBA pieces too, but the boxing we got more and more boxing dates, so I'm on the road all the time. I don't get a chance to do much, if any. But the intention was for me to do a lot of feature pieces on basketball, which obviously
any excuse you've got to
maybe one day
watch Zion, definitely see him up close. Worth the price of admission. It's crazy. I mean, I can't believe what he's doing after missing 3 months and only 19 games or whatever it was. Well, Mark, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it, and you guys should, you know, definitely check out Pistol if you haven't already. Just really, really interesting on father and son and a player who's in a lot of ways ahead of his time.